Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB and of course on our podcast. I'm Ailey Packham and we are celebrating goals against England in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Yes, that's right, with no Albion action taking place, we have been cheering on our players who've been representing their countries in this week's World Cup qualifiers. None more so than Jakob Moda, whose goal against England would have given Gareth Southgate a reminder that Brighton players do actually exist. It was also a good week for Leandro Trossard, who notched his first and second goals for Belgium as they put eight past Belarus. This weekend, though, we return to action and we will certainly have some unfinished business with Man United after their penalty after the final whistle robbed us of a point earlier this season at the Amex. Joining me today as we cast an eye over all of this is, of course, Alan Wares, and the band is back in session as Marcus Hancock's and Andy Batters here. And we'll also have a chat with former Albion striker Andy Ritchie, and we will catch up with Attila the stockbroker, also known as John Bain. Well, welcome back to the Raw, guys. Nice to see you all. How you been?
Yeah, good.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, good.
And Marcus, your Albion mojo fluctuates quite a lot. So where's it at this week?
Well, let's put it this way. I'm still not proclaiming him as Jesus just because we won a couple of home games. But at the same time, yeah, it's good to see that we're actually starting to win football matches, which we've been threatening to do for probably the best part of the whole season. So the fact that we've finally done that, to me, is can only mean one thing, that we're on the right path finally.
Yep. Andy?
Yeah, my mojo has recovered from the rather soul-destroying run of defeats. I mean, unlike Marcus, I've been a Potter fan throughout the whole season. But yeah, the my mojo's been really up on the back of the last two performances. It's just nice seeing us get the job done. I don't think it's really about getting overexcited about beating moderate opponents. It's about just getting the job done and looking like we mean business, and I cannot wait for Sunday night's game. It's an exciting prospect.
Now, Marcus, it's a very simple equation that goals win football matches, and we've started scoring some goals.
Yeah, who'd have thought, eh? That actually putting it in the back of the net actually results in 3 points. Now, listen, I've been up and down about it, I'll be honest, but it's because it's probably been so frustrating in last season and this season that we've done everything but put the ball in a net. I mean, it's incredible. And that Twitter, someone put a compilation of Twitter of all the sort of misses over the season. It's just like, oh, it don't watch it if you're in a bad mood, because it's just going to make you even worse. Let's put it that way. But honestly, you know, it finally the players have, yeah, probably I've been a bit harsh on Potter, but finally the players have stood up and realized that it's their job to win football matches. And let's hope they carry on knowing that they can win football matches. And yeah, okay, the United game, it's exciting. If we don't get much out of that, fine. It's winning our home games, and our home record has been absolutely appalling. There's no way of slicing it. You can't sugarcoat it. It's abject. That needs working on. And thankfully, the win against Newcastle was such a blessed relief. I thought after Spurs and getting a good draw against Liverpool, we were going to, you know, when we played them earlier in the season, that we were going to do really well. But let's hope that Newcastle game, which I know you've talked about on the show before, was an absolutely fantastic performance from start to finish, frankly. And let's have some more of that going into the, you know, the last sort of 7-8 games of the season or whatever.
Let me put that into context for you then, Marcus. I mean, you know, we were talking about the Spurs and Liverpool games, and there seemed to be a little bit of a zeitgeist. We beat Leeds as well, which was, you know, sort of funny slash farcical because we played it on a potato field. But if you look at those home records, and you're right, the home record is abysmal. In that time, we played Palace and we played Leicester. And certainly for a game and a half, well, the Palace game was beyond farce, wasn't it? I mean, it was so ridiculous. And I think probably highlighted more than anything to the whole world just how abysmal our striking was. Leicester, we turned up for half a game and then just sort of like, you know, just seemed to hit the wall. So you get to realise that, you know, I think this is where I think probably somewhere between Andy's mojo and Marcus's mojo is the reality of the fact that we haven't, there's very, very few games where we've played poorly. But now that we've actually sort of started scoring goals, And certainly with Newcastle, yeah, of course, they were poor opposition, but they were very, very good goals. There's no excuse. I mean, like, you know, you saw Trossard's goals for Belgium this week. You see that they can do it. And this is what, you know, I suspect, Marcus, this is where your frustration comes from. You see that they can do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
I also saw your comments this week, Marcus, where you compared Leandro Trossard to Paul Brooker. And it's quite a good parallel, to be honest.
Yeah, I think it was the same last season as well. But when the sun shines, or when it gets a bit warmer, Leandro Trossard is going to be an outstanding player, just like Paul Brooker was back in with Dean Blaise. He disappeared in winter, but come spring, wow, what a player. And I think we can file Trossard under that for the moment.
But now we've got looking like lockdown is starting to ease. The sun's coming out and everyone's leaving litter everywhere. Please don't, if you're coming to our brilliant city. But now it looks like that's happening. And there's a possibility of certainly the last two Premier League games are going to have at least some fans in them. Up to 10,000 is the target for the government at the moment. It leads me, I mean, I think it's a speculative thing, but let me throw this open to you three. Do you think that the Albion at home, bearing in mind what you were talking about, Marcus, with Albion's poor record at home, do you think the Albion would have done better with even 10,000, but certainly a 30,000 crowd at home? Or do you think that the players, given how they can their scoring record is, would have ended up with stage fright? I mean, I'll just be curious to know what it is you think, how it is you think. Let's start with you, Andy. How it is you think the team would have done?
I think they would have done better, to be honest. I think there's although ironically, we didn't win the two games we did have fans. but that was only 2,000. But I think full houses against Man United, Palace, Leicester would have just put us over the edge and maybe just pulled back the opposition a little bit.
Man United game, Andy, is an absolute case in point. I mean, I'm still fuming about the fact that not about the penalty, but it was that extra time that the ref added on after. The ref would, if there was a full Amex there, the ref would have blown the final whistle after Solly had equalised. Yeah. Because where he found that extra 5 minutes from is beyond me. Because
Marcus?
I thought about it quite a lot, actually, because our home record, again, with fans wasn't particularly great even last season. So, but I think in the context of some of the games we've played this season, I think the fans would have helped. As AD said, you know, a full Amex or even 10,000 fans at the Amex would have been getting the referee to blow the whistle at the Man United game after Solly equalised. Palace, I think the players would have, the fans would have sort of wheeled the ball into the net and been the 12th man. So I think it would have made a bit of a difference. Whether it would have made a lot of a difference, I still don't know, because it's an unknown. It's, you know, it's Liam Brady.
I appreciate it's hypothetical, absolutely, but
it's an interesting conjecture, but on balance, I think it certainly would have helped more than hindered. But one thing would be for certain, that if we were having that run with full stadiums, and Potter would probably not have been in a job now, because it went sour under Sammy when the home record and fans are infighting. And if we did have that record, what would have probably is a fact is if the fans are in a stadium and we had had that run, I don't think Potter would have been in a job. Yeah, it's all
but Marcus, under Sammy, under Sammy Hoopier there, I mean, awful. The performances were awful, absolutely awful. I mean,
but you still need to win football matches, and we weren't doing that. But anyway, you know, it's all
Are there individual players who you feel perform better, you know, in an empty bowl compared to, I mean, do you feel that, I mean, the whole management notion of carrot and stick, who responds better to carrot and who responds better to stick, that some players have, flourished in empty stadiums. I mean, let's name names, Marcus. Is there anyone who thinks, you know, once the crowds are back, you know, they're not going to be the players that they have been?
Probably Solly March is one, I think. He's been excellent during, and it's a shame he's really got injured, because he was really performing this season. Mm-hmm. and it's a real shame that he's injured. I think the empty stadiums has probably helped him because he's definitely a confidence player. And, you know, we've all been guilty of it even in the past when someone, a player like Dale Stevens, for example, gets a ball, messes up a pass and there's a collective groan around the stadium and you kind of, you know, but obviously if you do that in an empty stadium, you know, you're probably going to get Adam Lallana shouting at you if he's on the pitch. But having said that, you know, you haven't got the sort of, you know, you can't feed in from the crowd. So I think Solly March is definitely someone who probably has definitely stepped up with no fans in the stadium.
Marcus, there was your bet noir last season, which was Adam Webster, who this season has gone from strength to strength. And he's been outstanding this season. I mean, he was one player that was certainly, the crowd was on his back last year.
Yeah, I think so. Certainly in the early part of the season they were. And if I'm going to be honest, rightly so, because he was dropping wickets left, right and centre that, frankly, you know, he shouldn't have been making. However, having said that, he's grown as a player. There is no question. You know, there was always a player there. And now, finally, he's starting to show it. And he's been excellent. You're right. He's been absolutely excellent. And again, in that run of games where, you know, Palace, I think West Brom and Leicester, he was missing from the defence. And, you know, and we needed him then. There's no question. Mm-hmm. Potter, to his credit, has reshuffled the defence and found another winning formula because he's lost Lamptey, he's lost Webster. So, you know, credit where credit's due. You know, he's shuffled the deck and he's come up with another. And what seems to have happened is the wacky team selections have now gone, where you're ending up with Jahanbakhsh in goal and, you know, riding up front and all that other nonsense that he was doing. Sort of, you know, he stopped all that as well, which, again, to his credit. So, yeah.
Okay, well,
and breathe. Andy, I mean, along the same lines in that case, do you feel that Neil Maupay, I'm going to zero in on him, who, let's face it, is actually, you know, has reached epic level of trolling and outhousery, is someone who would actually benefit from playing in a full stadium?
I think he would. I mean, the point I was going to make was about the players that seem to have come out of their shell, is that quite often you hear teams talk about players and about what they do in training, and you find it frustrating that you don't see it week in, week out. But actually, without the external influence of the fans and the feedback from the fans, the players are now getting the feedback from each other in a similar way that they do during training. So basically, that they are kind of like almost like glorified training sessions. So the affirmation that they get during the week is now translated into a match day performance, which I find quite interesting. I think that has been a factor for some players.
Mm. I mean, this is something which I spoke to Andy Ritchie about, and he's got an opinion about playing in empty stadiums as opposed to players riffing off the crowd. So we're going to talk to you about your time at the Albion in a bit, but just tell us how's lockdown been for you?
Just the same for everybody, I think. It's been rather boring. Just got to get through it, got to do it. Been self-isolating, really, for virtually that full year. You know, there's obviously been little bits and bats where you've been able to get out a little bit. But even then, before the vaccine came out, I didn't really want to go and chance getting anything or catching anything. Turned 60 in November, so I thought, right, I better just keep myself to myself. And me and the wife have been indoors most of the time, and hopefully it's going to get a little bit better now. Had the first jab, and we've got to still be careful, obviously, and, you know, lunatics don't go and spoil what's just budding, if you like.
Yeah, I mean, you're seeing that up and down the country, aren't you? And it's been a very, very tricky time for absolutely everybody. And one thing that is a constant out for people is football, you know. And with people not being able to go to games and not to be able to see their mates and have that camaraderie that you do at a football match, it's very difficult, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, I mean. Excuse me, I had lots of conversations about, you know, not having fans at games. And, you know, I've always sort of advocated that I have played in front of zero fans, you know, professionally and coming up through the ranks, and maybe played in front of 30 fans and 40 fans. And I've always wanted to be the best player on that football pitch. And that's what motivated me. But I'm sure it's been very, very difficult for the players. I'm sure that there's been some very strange score lines, hasn't there? You know, they've gone through because I think maybe the atmosphere isn't there. But I think you've just got to try and self-motivate yourself. And I think they're probably used to it now, the players. You know, I think they've got it back as a norm. Mm. It'll be strange now for them to go back and have, you know, whatever it starts at, 2,000, 10,000, whatever it is. It'll be strange to have that actual contact and the people, you know, cheering you on. It'll be it might be difficult for them to handle that. I don't know.
It's maybe, just maybe.
Time, isn't it?
Well, you've played with a heck of a lot of really amazing players over your career, and I mean some of those absolutely like vibe off the crowd, having them. Some like getting the stick and giving it back, and others like when the crowd's on their backs, they don't like it. So I mean, it works both ways, really, doesn't it?
It does, and some like players, like you say, are fragile. Some aren't. I used to love both. You know, if they were chanting for me, it was great. It gave me a lift. If they were, you know, giving me a bit of stick and what have you, I loved that as well because I fed off that. So I wanted to shut them up. But some players, well, all players are different, aren't they? But some can't just take the stick side of it sometimes. Others don't like maybe the adulation. And that's strange, isn't it? But I do know that you know, I've played with players where they're not too keen whether they, you know, when they get the Lord in it. And I think it feels as though, oh, I've got to sort of stay in that mode. I've got to live up to what they've already, you know, said to me. And sometimes that was difficult.
Okay. Well, let's actually go there then. I mean, you came to the Albion, you made 102 appearances. You scored 26 goals and the side at the wrong end of the top flight, which is a pretty decent return actually. But you talk about getting stick off the crowd and not necessarily being a crowd favourite. And you had to fill the boots of a certain Peter Ward.
I did. And we became firm friends, really good friends, when he came back to the football club and I was still there. In fact, they used to call us, the lads called us the bookends because we were always sat next to each other. Got on with him. He had a very, very similar sense of humour to mine.
Did he ever buy you a drink?
You know what? I'm trying to think back now. I'm not sure whether he did.
He didn't.
He didn't. No, he was great, Wardy. We did hit it off when he came back. But yes, it was... It didn't affect me, actually. I mean, I knew how big he was at Brighton. He was a legend there. And when he moved on, I was coming in to try and fill those boots. But it didn't bother me. I was very lucky. I've been very lucky throughout my career. I didn't let things like that affect me. I tried to just water off a duck's back, but you know, brush it away. Because all I could do was what I could do and try the best for the fans and for myself. As I say, I used to go out in every game. I wanted people like yourself and the fans and the papers to be saying he was man of the match. He was brilliant today. And that was my motivation to try and play as well as I could. So people would say that. And I'm not being big-headed there. That's what I wanted. I wanted to be the best player on the football pitch.
Yeah. Where do you think you stand on the all-time Albion goal-scoring list in the top flight?
I would not have a clue.
Have a guess. What do you reckon? Top 10?
I wouldn't have said that I would be in the top 10. I thought I'd be outside that, definitely.
Okay, but this is just in the top flight. So in the first division, you were second for a very, very, very long time. But
what's that?
Yeah, but you're actually down to third because Glenn Murray's got three more goals than you. Mickey Robinson leads that shot with 37. Glenn Murray 26, you 23. Neil Maupay is just behind you on 18. So you're in very, very good company there.
I'm very surprised as well. Robbo, obviously I played with Robbo. He was my strike partner. He was the one that got all the knocks and kicks and what have you. And I sort of did my little bit in and around him. So Robbo was great. He was a great player to play with, and he was a favourite as well. I think the fans down there, the Goldstone, loved him. He was a marauder, wasn't he? You know.
Oh, he was great.
He played with a smile on his face, Robbo, which we all tried to do. You know.
And he was a bit of a chef as well, by all accounts. But I mean, were you surprised to see that he went on to have such a big career in Spain, particularly not necessarily on the pitch, but off the pitch?
No, he was very learned guy. He was very clever. Was always into reading and stuff like that. He was into classical music and stuff like that. I shared a flat with him for quite some time when I first went down there, about 6 months. And I was into me rock and roll stuff, and I'd come in after training. Maybe I'd been somewhere else and come in, and he'd have Debussy or Tchaikovsky on or something like that. Jesus, come on, Mick, get this rubbish off, you know. But he was a great guy. Yeah, got on really well with him. I think we sort of bonded because he'd been at Main Road as well. He'd been at City, and I'd obviously started my career at Manchester United. And we had that little bit of a connection, and we got on really well.
Well, I mean, I've got an interview you did with the Albion programme back in 82. Can you guess what your favourite food was back then?
Fine. I think I get a hell of a lot of stick about this. I played with a veterans team on a Thursday, and this pops up every so often. I think it's Dover sole and milk, isn't it?
Dover sole is right, and steak. And your favourite music in 1982 was David Bowie, Human League, and Pink Floyd. So,
definitely. David Bowie is my all-time hero. I used to love David Bowie, but Pink Floyd, I really do like them. Human League, I was into them when they first came out. I think they got a bit too poppy after that, but the first album. I think was a little bit off the wall, so I quite enjoyed that. But Bowie and Pink Floyd. But I've gone on from there now. I'm into everything. I've got no hair to rock it out and do the I'm a bit of a Metallica fan and Slipknot and things like that. And I like all types of sort of heavy music. And I still like Bowie and stuff like that. But
You're singing from the same hymn sheet as me, actually. So it's, Al, my co-presenter on this, is probably just like falling off his chair now, going, "Oh my god!" We're all over the Metallica on this show. Okay, well let's you were brought to the club for a club record fee by Alan Mullery. Alan Mullery didn't last too long with you, he was a top manager and a hero here, still is. So talk to me about your relationship with Mullers.
I had had chance at United to speak to three clubs before I spoke to Brighton. One was Aston Villa, who was manager was Ron Saunders at the time. One was Arthur Cox up at Newcastle. He was just crackers. And the other one was Jeff Hurst, who was at Chelsea. And I had a chat with all of those three. I was assured that I still had a future.
This would have been 1980, so Villa would have just won the FA Cup as well.
Villa were a fantastic side, but Ron Saunders was, I'm afraid, he just did not have any personality for me at all. It was like watching paint dry talking to him. And so that went out the window. I didn't take to Jeff Hurst either. And I'd heard a few stories about Arthur Cox being as, I think we were talking off air about somebody saying as mad as a box of frogs, and he was. So when I came down and had a chat with Alan Mullery, he just was what I wanted in a manager. He was ebullient. He was so enamoured with the club. Yeah, we're going places. We're going here. We've got this. We've come up. We don't want to go straight down again. We want, you know, the club's got plans. We're bringing people in. We've got these players. And the players that were there, they excited me to want to play with them. You know, the likes of Steve Foster, Tony Grealish came in, absolutely brilliant player, God rest his soul. You know, Neil Nabb, people like that, Jimmy Case, who came to the club as well, and Robbo, Michael Robinson. Yeah. I was excited to be part of that that team. It didn't work out. We weren't that great, were we? we struggled for three of the seasons I was there, and were in the relegation places. But we had one good season, which I think we finished. Was it 11th or 10th?
13th.
13th.
It's still actually the highest placing ever for the Albion.
Right.
So
right.
And you finished top scorer of that season as well. So, but that was under Mike Bailey, who wasn't necessarily that popular on the terraces, but he was in the dressing room. Is that right?
He was brilliant. And his coach, John Collins, was brilliant as well. He was so dry. He was a very, very funny guy. He was a player's manager. He liked to be with the players, and he would have a laugh and a joke. But you knew when the boundaries had been crossed. You know, he was still the manager at the end of the day. And I really enjoyed playing under Mike Bailey. It was a good time. And he wanted to play exciting football, as Mullers did. And it was a good time with him. Things just went wrong when Jimmy Melia turned up.
But I mean, when you came to the Albion, obviously that was a weird transfer triangle, and you very nearly didn't come anyway, because, you know, if you'd have said no, then Wardy might have stayed, Birtles wouldn't have gone to Man United, and you wouldn't have come here. So that was a bit of a strange one. But obviously you were swapped for Terry Connor as well, when the club was on its way to the FA Cup final. So that must have really stung.
I think if I'd have said no, the triangle wouldn't have happened, I don't think. I still get a bit of stick from the Man United fans about me moving and Gary Birtles going there, because he didn't have the best of times at Old Trafford, having been an ultimate goal scorer, haven't he, at Notts Forest? And then obviously Wardy going the other way. So it was a strange one.
Yeah. But, actually, out of all of those three, your transfer is probably the most successful, because Wardy didn't hit it off at Forest either.
No. Yeah, I mean, slightly more successful than the other two, yeah. And it was, I knew again that, you know, Terry Connor, but when Terry Connor came the other way and I went up to Leeds, Terry didn't really want to move. So if he had have said no, then I would have still stayed at Albion, and I might have been involved in the FA Cup that year
in 83. If we got to the FA Cup final of the 90s, I think the Albion story would be very different now. Your record in the top flight was very, very decent. You scored lots of goals. In fact, when we recently won at Anfield this season, your name was mentioned in dispatches, because you were the last person to score a winner there.
I was. And again, I got a few text messages off the lads I play with, saying, oh, you've been, he's every 2 minutes he's saying that you scored the goal and all this. I wish I could have said, like, it was a screamer, you know, it was 30 yards and it was a fantastic goal. I said, but I can't pull the wool over your eyes. I think I was actually on the floor in the 6-yard box when I actually just toe poked it, and it might have hit somebody's a defender's leg, and it bobbled over the keeper and ended up there. But it was in front of the cop, and it was a winning goal. So you can't take that away from me.
We're certainly not going to try, but before we move on, we've got to talk about. I mean, obviously, you came to Brighton. Brighton's a fun place to be. I mean, you came from Manchester, which is notoriously wet. There was a story I heard where you were talking about some of the nightclubs down here when you had to wipe your feet on the way out.
Yeah, well, there was only one. There was the King's Club, which was very posh, and they used to. Well, because it's a one club town, isn't it? You know, one club town, Brighton. So they all knew us. We used to get in for nothing, you know, and they'd probably get a couple of free drinks. And I'm just trying to think what the name of the other one was, but that was like you used there was, to walk there was, out.
The one that you mentioned was Bonsoir, which is something.
Bonsoir, that was it.
I mean, yeah, I thought you were more of a Hungry Years man, to be honest. But I mean, that was certainly going back then. So the famous rock club, which is actually back up and running again, actually. But But it's certainly a fun place to play. And the players, I understand that most of your teammates like to drink as well.
Yeah, I think we did. I think the social life got in the way of the football, or was it the other way around? Football got in the way of the social life. We did like a drink, but it was different then. That was the culture at that time. You know, everybody was doing it, so it wasn't as if we were just on our own having a drink. Every team used to have maybe a Tuesday club or whatever. They'd go out because they played on a Tuesday, or they knew that they would get a day off on the Wednesday. And of course, it was different then. You, the pubs used to shut from 12 till 2 o'clock. So there was a lot of little clubs and what have you, you know, like you'd see in...
Minder.
On Minder, yeah. You know, you'd go down and have a little drink in there between the 12 and 2. And,
yeah, go down to the Winchester and wait for it to all blow over.
That's right. But, I mean, listen, we did like a drink, and we were good off the pitch as well. I think virtually every single player in the squad played golf, and we used to play golf a hell of a lot. We used to go and the club actually used to pay for us to. They'd say, where are we playing? They'd see Fozzie, where are your lads playing at the weekend? Oh, we're playing at Hayward's Heath, or we're playing here, or we're playing at somewhere Peace Haven or wherever, you know, it was, and they'd pay for us to go and play at the golf clubs. It was a fantastic club. They looked after the players.
Yeah, you don't necessarily hear that about some other clubs as well, which is
which is
interesting, because I mean we from the outside looking in, it's just our club. So Danny Wilson was saying the same last week about, you know, that certain clubs that he's at, and it was just chalk and cheese compared to what the atmosphere when he came to the Albion and the way that you're treated off the pitch, as well as being able to prepare to get on it. But we've got to move on. We've got a big game this weekend. Obviously, you currently work for MUTV. I mean, Brighton. Well, the international break came at the wrong time for us. We just started to like show what we're capable of, and but the goals have finally started to go in. As a striker yourself, when you saw the chances that we've been creating this year, I mean, as a striker, you must I wish I was in that side.
Yeah, the game at your place, you probably should have beat Manchester United.
They probably about it.
Well, no, yeah, the woodwork saved us that game, obviously. But you know, I'm thinking, you know, you're talking about the break. Trossard scored, hasn't he, in the for Belgium? You know, so he's on a bit of a roll. I like him. You've got some fantastic players. I love Maupay as well. I think he's all energy and he's got a goal in him. But yeah, I would. Yeah, they do excite me, and it's a it's strange that where they are, you know. I mean, I think that definitely, from what I've seen of Brighton, they should be higher in the league. They've just been very, very unlucky with some of the results that have gone their way.
But we do have what used to be seen as a thoroughbred striker in Danny Welbeck.
Yeah, I mean, Danny's, I think, you know, I've watched him come up through the ranks at Man United because I've been working there for quite some time. And I think, unfortunately for Danny, I think he's suffered with injuries. And I think probably had he not, he probably might still, you know, be involved at England level. But he's just had a terrible time with injuries. But he's one of those players that I think he can play anywhere, you know, along the front anyway. He's obviously played down the middle for yourselves. Recently, I think he's been down the left-hand side, hasn't he? That goal he scored a couple of weeks ago.
Against Newcastle, yeah.
Off the left, yeah. But he will give you 100% all the time, Danny. He's one of those players that you know he's going to work his socks off for you. But unfortunately, I think maybe one or two injuries have taken a toll and probably he's not at the level that he might have still been had he not had them injuries.
Yeah, I mean, he's only just turned 30. So it's like, you know, which is still relatively young in football, in striker terms.
People say that's your prime, don't they, Aidan? You know, they're going up to your 30s. I think I certainly thought that myself, that, you know, from 27 to 30 to 31, I felt as though I was in my prime. I knew where to be on the pitch. I was pitch savvy. And I felt like I'd learned more out of the game and I knew what was going on, if you like. Mm. That might sound strange, but those years, it seems to click to you sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's particularly, I mean, with the manager like we have at the moment in Graham Potter, I mean, those players are constantly, even, I mean, there was some great interviews with Danny Welbeck and Adam Lallana this week, where they're saying that they're constantly learning and they're amazed with some of the stuff that Graham Potter's coming up with and some of the tactical changes and innovations, if you like, that he's bringing to their games.
That's great. I mean, you know, I felt that until the day I hung my boots up, that I was learning. Every single day I learned something, whether it be in training, whether it be about, you know, tactics or whatever. But for people like that to say that they are still learning off a young, you know, coach like Graham, I think is a good testament, because it's very hard to come up with new ideas. You know, everybody would turn around and say to you in football, it's just that idea rehashed. So that sounds refreshing. It really does.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about United then. There's a possibility that Rashford could still be injured. Lindelof is struggling. You've got a lot of players coming back from the international breaks. I mean, what sort of side do you think that they'll put out, and have Brighton got a chance in this game?
Well, I think they have to take, you know, Brighton have to take, excuse me, some solace and opportunity from the game down at the Amex. They've got to.
I'm still seething. Really still well. Seething about that. I mean,
listen, we'll get
a penalty when you get given a penalty after the final whistle. You know something's not right. I mean. We're not arguing that it wasn't a penalty. It was handball. But the fact is, The final, when Solly equalised, there was only actually 10 seconds left on the clock, and yet the referee managed to find another 5 minutes.
Well, the thing is that was VAR-driven, wasn't it? It wouldn't have happened had there been no VAR.
No.
That would have ended, the game would have ended, and that would have been it, and that goal wouldn't have stood. So... We can debate and talk about VAR for ages. Right. It's not stopped us talking about games afterwards, and it's intent, wasn't it, to stop us talking about penalty decisions and stuff like that.
They certainly stopped us talking about the pub, but that's because the pub's not open. It's like
yeah, exactly. But I mean, but that one, that was so strange, wasn't it? I mean, it's like it reminded me of was it a Brazil goal in the World Cup where he blew as a corner came across and somebody headed it in or something, and he disallowed the goal because I blew.
Oh, that was the Clive Thomas thing,
wasn't it? Yeah, Clive Thomas. Yeah, yeah. It was similar. That brought the actual, you know, schmozzle that went after the final whistle sort of brought that back to me.
It was just joking. I mean, we certainly owe United one this weekend after that. Leo Trossard, I've got the perfect hat trick in that game. Left post, right post and crossbar. He scored an absolute pearler in the week for Belgium. Twice he scored, actually. And that will do his confidence. And he knows how to get it between the sticks at the moment. So that's good.
As well about the Man United team. I think, you know, we'll know more probably tomorrow. I'm doing the press conference tomorrow for MUTV, and we'll probably know more there about who's come back with injuries or who hasn't had any injuries. I know Rashford went away initially. I'm not sure whether he came back. He had a foot injury. Whether he'll be fit for the game on Sunday, I'm not sure. Lindelof has been struggling with a back injury virtually all season. And he's been nursed through games. Eric Bailly, I'm not sure. Maybe I don't think he's. He might have fell out with the manager, I think, because he thought he should have been playing in the Europa League a couple of weeks ago, and there was a report saying that he was a little bit disappointed and he wasn't involved, I think, in the game after. But he's had niggly injuries as well. You know, you've expected him to be in the team sheet and. He's not been on the team sheet at times, so it's like you say, you don't know until they come back and they have that fitness analysis with the fitness gurus and the physios.
But thanks for joining us, Andy. We're not going to ask you for a prediction. we'll have a chat with you another time, because you know you're very welcome back here. I understand you haven't been to the Amex yet.
No, I haven't. No, I've not had a chance to. I would love to go down and go to the Amex. Definitely, it will happen. Obviously, I'm afraid my allegiances are with Man United on Sunday, my first club. And I wish Brighton all the best after Sunday, definitely. And I always look out for the score lines.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Andy, and we'll speak to you again soon.
Cheers, Andy. Thanks, mate.
Okay, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. The show, as ever, is brought to you in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com, and Phil has given us a great shirt of the week. So, Andy Bass, can you have a quick look at this one for me and describe it?
It's actually very stylish. Basically, very simple shirt, nice, big red, bold red shirt with a blue and white hoop across the midriff, with a badge with a blue and white crest with some kind of a lion on it. It's very simple and stylish. I like it. It's kind of like the centre stripe is sort of like Sampdoria-esque. Yeah. The sponsor is ICA Handle Lana. I'm going to say that this is maybe a Scandinavian team, possibly like a Swedish team that I don't know. But
is that because it's got Volvo written on it?
Because it's got Volvo written on it.
Handle Lana looks like it might be Swedish.
But it's a really, really nice shirt. Blue and white and blue collar at the top. I'm not a big fan of the collars, but... but all in all, that is a really nice shirt. I like it. I love the red on it. It's very bold.
Okay. Marcus, do you want to give us a year on this one?
A year? That's a good question. I can't give a year. I was thinking it's more French or Belgian, the shirt, just because it's quite stylish and Quite tireless kick, and there's nothing wrong with collars. Let's say 1992.
The thing is, when it comes to this shirt, I think Andy's got a point about it looking very Sampdoria-esque, but that crest on there is not the crest of Genoa, which is basically the same. So I'm going to go back down Andy's route and reckon it's Sweden. And if I'm going to say Sverige, then there's only one team I can think of, and I'm going to guess, therefore, Östersunds.
You're wrong with the team.
But it is Sweden.
This is what Phil has to say about this shirt this week. He says, here's your shirt of the week, chosen because I quite like it. Thanks, Phil. This is the 1992-94 away shirt. Good guess there, Marcus, of Swedish behemoth IFK Göteborg from Gothenburg in the south of Sweden. And they play in the top flight in Sweden, known as the Allsvenskan. Göteborg are the only side from a Nordic country to have won a UEFA competition. In fact, they've won two, the UEFA Cup in 1982 and in 1987. Rather greedily, they go by three nicknames, Blåvitt, which translates to be blue-white, Anglama, the Angels, and Katalerma, which is the Comrades. And they play in the 18,416 capacity Gamla Ullevi Stadium, which they share with neighbours GAIS and Örgryte from the Superettan League. The club was formed in 1905 and their home colours are blue and white. And since 1910, it's been blue and white stripes. They won the league 18 times and have 23 domestic cup titles as well. Some notable former players include Torbjörn Nilsson, who is regarded as one of the best ever Swedish players. Just over 100 appearances and 65 goals over two spells with the club, most recently in the 85-86 season. Defender Roland Nilsson, and no relation to Torbjörn, played 124 league appearances between 83 and 89, and the legendary goalkeeper Thomas Ravelli, who played over 250 times for the side and made 143 appearances for the Swedish national side between 81 and 97. A few links to the UK for you. The aforementioned Roland Nilsson played 151 league games for the massive Wednesday between 1994 and 97, and a handful of games for Coventry in 2001. And he's now IFK's manager. Sven-Göran Eriksson also managed the side between 79 and 82. Jesper Blomqvist played 73 times for Göteborg between 1993 and 96 and went on to play for Man United, Everton and Charlton before retiring in 2010. Glenn Heisen began his career with Göteborg in playing 122 games for them between 83 and 85. And he signed for Liverpool in 89 and played 72 times for them. And there is, of course, a Brighton link. Actually, two. Abdul Razak played on loan for us from Manchester City in 2012, and he signed for Göteborg in 2017 for just one season. And Brighton non-event, and Nzuzi Toko spent a year at Brighton in 2014 without making a league appearance, and he joined Göteborg in 2019 and played 21 times before moving to Würzburger Kickers in Germany. So thanks for that, Phil. And you'll be able to see that shirt on all our social media channels. Of course, you can go to oldfootballshirts.com and have a look at it there as well. There's over 110,000 shirts there of various different shades, including this one.
Now, for those of us old enough to remember all the way back to With Dean, yes, it's only 10 years ago, but actually we first got there 22 years ago. The club at the time always does things differently and appointed, probably for the first ever time, a poet in residence. Everyone knows who he is. Welcome back to the Albion Roar, John Bain, a.k.a. Attila the Stockbroker. How are you, John?
I'm all right. Good. Yep. Surviving lockdown, writing a lot. And my collected works is published on Monday, which is one of the reasons I'm here, obviously.
Fabulous. Absolutely.
40 years of my poems, plus a few of my song lyrics, with a substantial football section, which obviously contains the best known of my poetry that I've written over the years for the Albion. Two of which, the very best known ones, I'll be performing a bit later on. But yeah, it's this book is the culmination of 40 years of my work, and it's very, very fitting because it's being published by Cherry Red Books, which is the book division of Cherry Red Records, who published all my early albums in the 1980s and my autobiography in 2015, as you very well know, since you worked on it. So yeah, it's great. I mean, this should have been published last year. I should have been doing a massive tour. We all know what happened. Now I'm starting very tentatively to think about booking gigs again. Unfortunately, COPD that I've seems to have acquired in the last couple of years means I have to be careful, but I'm optimistic that I'll be back on the road again before the end of the year, hopefully a long time before that. And the book is published next Monday, as I say.
I assume you've been jabbed and everything.
I've had my first. I'm on the vulnerable list, so I've had my first. And hopefully, I'll obviously be getting the next one sometime in the next 2 months. I don't know when exactly.
Yeah. So you're not going to be sort of certainly looking to be out and about gigging or even if it was just to a party of six until you've had your second jab, I assume.
I'm getting out. I'm cycling. I'm very active. I'm just being careful. I'm wearing my mask and all the obvious stuff. And I'm going to start gigging outdoors from May. I mean, that's the plan. I've already had a couple of offers. Once it becomes legal to gig again, I've had a couple of offers of outdoor gigs. I have no problem performing outdoors. I bring my own microphone, I'm fine with that. And indoors, hopefully from July. After I've been jabbed twice and had the required period of time for it to sort of work and all the rest of it.
Okay, well, you're noted as one of the sons of Southwick. And a few months ago on the Albion Raw, we had Tony Kybert alongside yourself to highlight the plight that Southwick Football Club had, especially with due deference to how the council had mismanaged the previous leaseholders' tenure at Old Barn Way. Now, the story since then has kind of moved on fairly rapidly. So can you just give us a quick overview as to where you're at with that?
Yeah, very briefly, the lease is now being taken over by the Russell Martin Foundation, who are obviously, local.
There's an irony here, isn't there?
Russell
Martin being the manager of...
Yes, indeed, yes. Don't mention that franchise word, or that franchise words. He's Russell Martin, whose brother is going to be on our committee and lives over the road from me in Southwick, is Russell Martin Foundation taking over Old Barn Way in conjunction with the reformed Southwick Football Club, Southwick 1882 FC, which is a community club, which will be returning to Old Barn Way in August. We're not quite sure of the ramifications yet in terms of the long-term developments, but certainly the ground is going to have to be rebuilt. That's one of the things that has been established so far. So it's going to be a while before we're going to be back to full operation. But the club is the matches start again, tomorrow, and we're looking very much at getting promotion this season, getting back into the feeder system, and progressing up the leagues, because the aim ultimately is to restore Southwick to its former glory of the 1960s and 70s, which all older people will know about.
Absolutely. Well, I think they've even made it to quite far in the FA Cup once upon a time.
First round 1974, FA Cup fourth qualifying round 1991, and into the Isthmian League first division in the 1980s. So, yeah.
I mean, it's been quite a community shift, hasn't it, in these past few months, hasn't it?
Well, there's a lot of people behind it. It's quite interesting. And for the first time in my life, I'm having an involvement in amateur non-league football, which I find, interesting. It's completely different from everything else that I've done involved in the game before. It's quite uplifting to be able to do something to help my local club. I'm on the committee. I should be organising fundraisers and doing some of the social media stuff, and obviously writing. I'm still 100% committed to the Albion, needless to say. I mean, it doesn't affect that in the slightest. Mm-hmm. One of the many reasons why I want us to stay in the Premier League is because obviously then, I mean, then we might be playing on Saturday afternoon, so we'll be able to watch the Wickers as well. But we'll see. I mean, but things are looking up. That's all we can say at the moment. Things are definitely looking up.
Absolutely. And good luck to Southwick 1882, as they're now known, going forward from here. Listen, well, obviously, I said at the top of this section, I said that, you were crowned Brighton and Hove Albion's poet in residence in the early days of Dick Knight taking over. And one of the many aspects that, certainly with the book that you've got coming out, Heart on My Sleeve, is that there are so many facets of your life within the book. Now, there's obviously, there's your political considerations, there's your social considerations, there's your music, family, friends, and of course, football. And obviously, for people listening to the Albion Raw, the vast majority of people know who you are and know you for football, including, and I'm delighted to say you're going to to recite it again now. Probably a poem which I think really does touch the hearts of many of your contemporaries as well as yourself, but probably also worry one of the best football poems ever written. So could you do the Albion Raw listeners a favour and recite for us once again, Goldstone Ghosts?
Yeah, I mean, this is it's one of the poems of which I'm most proud in general, I will say. And it's as I've said many, many times, it isn't simply about the Albion and the battle to save the club. It's specifically, for me, a memory of my father who died when I was 10, and the greatest memories I have are of him taking me to football. So here we go. Goldstone Ghosts, written for the last ever game at the Goldstone. As bulldozers close in upon our old beloved home, and those who stand to profit rub their hands. So we gather here together in sad, angry disbelief, and for one last time, our voices fill the stands. This is no happy parting, but a battle-scarred farewell, though victory hopes are mingled with the tears. And I, like you, will stand here as the final whistle blows, with memories which echo down the years. The Chelsea fans threw pennies, old ones, sharpened. I was 8, a target in the south stand with my dad. And he got rather battered as he held me close and tight and confirmed my view that Chelsea fans were mad. And there, on those old wooden seats, I learned to love the game. The sights and sounds exploded in my head. My dad was proud to have a son with football in his blood, but 2 short years later, he was dead. 11, I went on my own. My friends liked chess and stuff. Now don't go in the north stand, said my mum, but soon I did. Kit Napier's corner, curled into the net. Oh God, the Bournemouth boot boys, better run. Then Villa in the big crunch game. A 30,000 crowd, bald lockhead school, but we still won the day. Then up and straight back down again. Brian Powney, brave and squat. T-Rex, DMs and scarf on wrist. Okay? And then the world was wonderful. Punk rock and Peter Ward with sidekick Spider Mella, tall and lean. The legendary Walsall game, promotion, riding high. Southampton Spurs, that stitch-up was obscene. The final glorious victory. Division 1 at last. Arsenal, first game, midst fevered expectation. Those Highbury gods tore us to shreds. We learned our lesson well. Steve Foster was our soul and inspiration. Man City came, and Jerry Ryan waltzed through them to score. And mighty Man United bit the dust. Notts Forest and that Williams screamer nearly broke the net. The Norwich quarter-final. Win or bust. And after Wembley, Liverpool were toppled one last time, the final curtain on those happy days. And then the years of gradual, inexorable decline, sadly for some, the parting of the ways. But we stayed true as glory days turned into donkey's years. Young, Trussen, Tiltman, Farrington, Eeyore. A Wilkins free kick nearly brought us hope. It was not to be. The rot was deep and spreading to the core. We found our voice and Lloyd was gone. Hooray! But worse to come. Though just how awful, we were yet to know. Fence turned to rebellion and then to open war as on the terrace weeds began to blow. The Goldstone soul behind our backs. Enraged, we rose as one against a stony northern businessman. We drew a line and said, enough. And as the nation watched, the final battle for our club began. We fought him to a standstill, fans united, all for one. A nation's colours joined, a glorious sight. And finally, the stubborn, stony archer moved his ground and made way for our own collective knight. The battle's only just begun. But we have won the war. Our club, though torn asunder, will survive. And I salute each one of you who stood up and said no and fought to keep the Albion alive. And one day when our new home's built and we are storming back, a bunch of happy fans without a care, we'll look back on our darkest hour and raise our glasses high and say with satisfaction, we were there. But first we have to face today, the hardest day of all. Don't worry if you can't hold back the tears. We must look to the future in dignity and peace, as well as mourn our home of 90 years. For me, the Goldstone has an extra special memory of the football soulmate I so briefly had. He christened me John Charles and taught me to love the game. This one's for Bill, a poet, and my dad.
Jeez. Fantastic. Absolutely fantastic, John. Thank you very much indeed. Now, we've asked you on to, obviously, to help plug your new book. Well, say your new book. It's 6 months since we worked on it. So it's covering 40 and a half years of you being Attila the stockbroker. So if anyone gets a copy of it, what are they going to expect? What can they expect?
Well, it is literally every, I mean, you know, I've all human life is here, really. I mean, one of the things that 40 years earning my living as a poet and writer and musician and songwriter has done for me is it's broadened me out in terms of my subject matter. I mean, I started off, I make no bones about it, really. I started off as fairly one-dimensional, angry, ranting poet in the 1980s. Of course, the football stuff was always there. But I tended not to write about personal things very much. In fact, Goldstone Ghosts was one of the first times when I really, really got into exploring my own personal emotions in terms of my father. And since then, that has increased hugely. It's all to do with growing older, really. I mean, there's a much, much more human side to my work, a much broader, deeper side to my work now than there would have been, say, 20 or 30 years ago. And I'm very, very pleased about that. It's logical that as you get older, that, you know, your work changes, the way that you express yourself changes, but in no way have I mellowed in terms of my politics, in terms of my vision of the world, remains absolutely as strong as it was 30, 40 years ago. But certainly the way that the subject matter and the kind of approach I take is different. There's lots of stuff about my mother's battle with Alzheimer's, about my own battles with bladder cancer. There's stuff about there was stuff written during lockdown, obviously, and all the ramifications of that. There's loads of poetry taken from my travels around the world, obviously lots of stuff about social history and lots of very surreal, just simply the sort of things that you couldn't make up that happened to you, like when we went to Albania in 1989 and with a bunch of When Saturday Comes fans, and we ended up doing the first ever secret gig in the Hotel Dieti in Tirana. It was just beyond belief stuff. I'm very, very proud of it. It's published on Monday by Cherry Red Books, as I say.
If you fancy winning a copy, we've got a copy of this, a signed copy to give away, courtesy of the Albion Roar and through Attila the stockbroker. And if you fancy a chance of winning a copy of this book, please just correctly answer the question that John is about to give you.
Yeah, okay. What's the connection between the publishers of my book and football? Simple as that.
Okay, and if you think
between the publishers of my book and football.
If you think you know the answer, send us an email to thealbionroar@yahoo.co.uk. That's thealbionroar@yahoo.co.uk. The closing date is Friday, the 9th of April. And from there, we will select a winning entry from all the correct answers. So just quickly, that question again, John.
What is the connection between the publishers of my forthcoming collected works and football?
And like I say, just send your answer to thealbionroar@yahoo.co.uk, and the winning answer we'll select at random and we'll get hold of you for your postal details. Now, like I say, that was a fantastic recital of Goldstone Ghosts. It is a superb poem, and I know it reduces many, many people to tears every time they hear it. I think it's very evocative for not just yourself, but for those who, Brighton fans who were there, who raised their glasses high and said with satisfaction that they were there. But then 20-odd years later, you kind of wrote a follow-up to that.
I did.
And showcased it an evening we had just when we got promotion to the Premier League, and that was on the 26th of April, 2017. I don't have to look these things up. It was we were just going to do an evening of 20 years since the end of the Goldstone. It ended up also being a celebration, being promoted, but you wrote a poem, a follow-up to Goldstone Ghosts, and I believe you're going to recite it for us now.
Yeah, obviously this one's in the book as well, and of course the wonderful thing about this one was it got a really good sort of place, because in our first game in the Premier League, I was asked to perform it for BT Sport before the first ever game, which, as we all know, was at home to Man City. So I was asked to perform the poem for BT Sport for a piece from before the game. Amusingly, the club wanted a certain part vetoed, which should obviously not be vetoed today. No. So this is from Hereford to here.
Uncensored.
Uncensored. The thing about the vetoing was, of course, it meant it didn't scan, but, you know.
Sure.
From Hereford to here. With sheer determination, a vision fine and clear, we made the noise which brought the boys from Hereford to here. Mid-90s, the fight back began. We met each Monday night and called for help to save our club. He answered, "Thanks, Dick Knight." So many colours joined with ours on Fans United Day, and then we drew at Hereford and drank the night away. A glorious celebration washed down by lakes of beer. We made the noise which brought the boys from Hereford to here. Homeless. Right, Brighton Council, find us somewhere to play, because we're the Seagulls party now and we'll vote you away. With Dean, Bobby Zamora. We really cut a dash. He scored the goals which took us up. I cheered and played the clash. With pride and dedication, not a hint of fear, we made the noise which brought the boys from Hereford to here. So welcome, world, to our new home. It took so blooming long. Petitions, demonstrations, the top 20 hit song. Our lovely Falmer Stadium. The board may not agree. I've never had a credit card. It's still Falmer to me. With hope and expectation and, yes, a little tear, we made the noise which brought the boys from Hereford to here. Now we're a bunch of fans again, all cheering on our team. A glorious end to 20 years, fulfilment of a dream. The Albion in the Premier League, and we've all played our part. We're more than corporate football, us. We're football's beating heart. This is our celebration, so have another beer. We've made the noise and brought the boys from Hereford to here.
Magnificent. And do you know what? Under the circumstances, I'd much rather be here than Hereford.
Too right. Although, good luck to Hereford in the semi-final of the FA Trophy they're doing this weekend. And I hope they get back in the league soon, because they've had a really rough time.
I really don't think they've forgiven us. Yeah, I mean, I've been down to Herefordshire quite a lot of times, and you still end up slightly persona non grata if you admit that you're a Brighton fan.
Oh, yeah, yes. I've had similar experiences myself.
Yeah, it's a funny experience. Listen, we've offered a giveaway of one copy of the book, but if you don't happen to win and you would like to buy a copy, John, where can you get a copy of your new book, Heart on My Sleeve?
Well, it's available now for pre-order, and they go out on Monday, because that's the official publishing date, from all major websites, booksellers, you know, Waterstones, Hive.co.uk, the internet, the independent one, obviously Amazon, all those ones. And specifically, if you'd like it signed or you just want to get it from me directly, you can get it from me from my Bandcamp page, which is my merch page, which is Attila the Stockbroker, all one word, two T's and one L, AttilaTheStockbroker.bandcamp, BANDCAMP.com. And it's £17 plus £4 for postage and packing.
And let it be known that the unsigned ones in 5 years' time will be worth a fortune. John, good luck with the book.
Thank you very much.
I've worked on it. I'm very, very biased, but I can say it is a superb anthology. You can see the 40 years running through it. Like I say, there's socialist movement, there's punk, there's life in Harlow, there's surrealism, there's the love for the family, there's the care for those around you. There's the football, of course, and all points in between, from A to Z and back again. Seriously, good luck with the book, John. Thanks very much indeed for coming on to the Albion Raw.
Thank you very much, Al. See you soon, mate.
Right. We've got to talk about the internationals, guys. I mean, he made his first start for the Albion against Newcastle, a very impressive one as well. But Jakub Moda, Andy.
Just continuing some fine form. Superbly taken goal. I must confess, I did not watch the match, but I have seen the goal, and I just thought the goal exemplified everything that's good about about him. Excellent closing down play to win the ball off Stones. I know that Stones has got a lot of criticism, but I think you have to credit Moda for being alive to the situation, quick thinking, and then a much better finish than he displayed at the beginning of the Newcastle match. So
it was actually a similar position, wasn't it?
Yeah, very similar. And he just looks like a very, very exciting prospect. Definitely a player to be excited about.
For those that watched the game, apparently he did absolutely nothing during the game.
No, it was anonymous mostly.
Yeah. But what he did do was basically
football for you though.
Yeah, absolutely. In closing down Stones that way, he was basically trolling Gareth Southgate, saying, hey, if Lewis Dunk was there, I wouldn't have got the ball. You idiot.
Yeah, definitely.
No, it's great that we can actually have, I mean, you know, let's face it, a few weeks ago, you know, he was literally no more than a Polish under 21 prospect. Now, I mean, he's come on as a substitute and done okay. And again, all right, we weren't playing the greatest opposition, but you can only, you know, play what's in, put in front of you. And he seemed very at home playing in the Premier League. He seemed to slot in when he was asked to do his job first. He started off at left wing back, a role taken up by Zakiri and Solly March, and the other side by Pascal Gross. So let's face it, when you were saying earlier, Marcus, about Potty choices, I think there's an air of total football about this, is that everyone is expected to play in every position before the season is out.
Or it's a rite of passage. Before you can play in your proper position, you've got to play left wing back.
Yeah, you've all got to do it.
You've all got to do it. Yeah.
But it was,
you'll see who the next rising star is when you see who's playing at left wing back.
And we can only speculate. But I mean, I suspect, bearing on with that in mind, I wouldn't have Pascal Grace playing there. I would probably move Veltman there.
So who would your back three be then?
Well, if he's fit, Dan Burn, Dunk.
And White.
And White, yeah.
And let's face it, Burn's a funny player, isn't he? He seems to be, and I'm probably being totally unfair here, he's either brilliant or he gets his backside handed back to him on a plate, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a good player, but when he makes a mistake, you tend to know about it, sadly.
Yeah, because he's head and shoulders above everyone doing that. But moving on, we're playing this game at Easter, and we've got to look back on, Easter games of yore. AD has been asking us, this panel, this band, as to your favourite games from Easter. And, well, AD, let's ask you first. I suspect you probably, everyone's going to zero in on the same game, but let's go for your one
first.
Well,
there's been a few memorable ones over Easter. There's been a couple of wins against Palace, which is always nice. But that was back in the 80s. But I think the one everyone's going to really remember, and it's certainly one I remember, and as being a whole day of just a wonderful chilled out day. It was a game that was on Easter Monday with Dean against Bristol City, and it was the game where we pretty much guaranteed we knew we were going to get promoted.
Was that the game that you two were going to go for?
No.
Wigan, surely. Yeah.
But actually, AD recalls, that Bristol City game is obviously the famous Lee Steele goal.
Lee Steele, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But it was an incredibly relaxing day, because I think it was an early kickoff, wasn't it?
It was a really early kickoff.
Repaired to a sort of lightly populated sportsman afterwards, and sort of enjoyed the sunshine as the other results came in our favour, and just sort of eased our passage up through the leagues yet again.
Is that the one where Kuipers made save after save after save?
Yes, he did make some good saves in that game.
Yeah, and it was, I think Bobby scored the other goal as well, didn't he? But it was just that light, watery sunshine that day, and like a slight haze. And I mean, I was living in Newbury at the time, and I remember coming down early for, I think it was a 1 o'clock kickoff. I think it was live on telly as well, I think. But I just remember after the game, feeling super relaxed, sitting on the beach with a beer, and it was just a snapshot in time that's just like bookmarked in my memory, and it was just such a wonderful day.
Play some Mantovani under this.
Yeah. Our song. Yeah.
Let's talk about something a bit more contemporary. Marcus, do you have any memory of Easter Monday 2017?
Easter Monday 2017. I do, but that wasn't my choice because I knew that other people would have it, you see. So,
which is yours?
Well, mine is obviously still, I would believe, a British record.
It's the one I thought of.
I'm Glenwell. At the time, it was my first trip to and Selhurst, and obviously our friend Kelvin Morton of the. Yeah. Of the five penalties, and it was a blazing hot. I mean, it was a blazing hot Monday. It was the day of still when the inflatable bananas were still fashionable, and that was, it was an interesting game. You know, Palace had four penalties and missed three, and we got one penalty and scored it. The highlights are on YouTube. Looking back on it, probably they were the correct decisions, but of course, at the time when you're in the stands, they were not the correct decisions at all. that was a memorable for me. That was my most memorable Easter Monday because, as you say, 2017 is probably.
I have got another one as well, actually, which was a little bit more recent. It was actually that 2017 season, and it was we were away at Wolves. We won 2-0, two goals from Antti Nokka. I wasn't actually at the game. I was actually in Spain at the time, watching it in a bar over there. And
sitting on a beach on a hazy summer, early summer day.
Beer in hand.
Mantovani playing.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. But again, that was a time you kind of realised that the promotion was definitely on.
Wolves game was Good Friday, was it?
Yeah,
Wolves game was Good Friday. I was there for that one. Bless him, Worthing Paul had tears in his eyes because he knew we were going to do it. QPR did kind of, nudge us in the right direction. I think we played QPR away, which was the game before, but the Wolves one was, as AD said, the one that really probably cemented it. QPR tipped us into the edge. Wolves put us one foot in the promotion.
I have to say, because you did ask us earlier, and I just have a terrible memory for sort of noting like the seasons when I remember the game, or I don't. I don't really sort of remember when it was, but obviously that is the one that sticks in my mind. It was just an incredible day. I mean, the game was fairly sort of humdrum,
do not go on the pitch.
But the best bit of the day for me was just hanging around waiting for the Huddersfield game to finish, and then it was the second pitch invasion.
Yes,
which was just the highlight for me because there was still a lot of people left. I'd say about five to
probably about 2/3 the size of the original pitch invasion.
Yeah, it's about 5,000 or 6,000 people still left. So a lot of people were still there hanging on, and it was just insane. You had the players running across the pitch from the to get to where their sort of new players' lounge was on the east stand, and it was just mayhem, and it was just absolutely fantastic. And
didn't Lewis Dunk go in his pants?
That's what I was going to say. I'm sure that was
it. Yes, he did.
He got them stripped off of him as he was leaving the pitch. He did get dressed for the second pitch invasion, where all the players ended up in their east stand bar. Yeah. He did manage to get redressed by them, but he did get debagged all the way down to his trolleys trying to leave the pitch.
But it was an absolutely just insane day, and it was just sort of kicking off in a good way, sort of all over town. And obviously the infamous train ride by the players, just the crowds everywhere. I mean, I was done.
Yuri Skalak's picture the day after.
Yeah. I mean, I was done in by 9 o'clock. I mean, it was just...
So you were exhausted by the time you got to the pub, didn't you?
There we were, the Battle of Trafalgar, and I just thought, I think I'm tapped out. But it was just absolutely fantastic. So I missed out on some of the further scenes as they all went down West Street and all that malarkey. But it was like the whole time, the whole town, fantastic.
Well, we've all got some great memories there. And Easter's not all about chocolate and Easter bonnets and bunnies, is that we've had some happy footballing memories as well. But that is all we've got time for. So thank you to Marcus Hancocks, to Andy Bass, to Alan Wares, to Andy Ritchie, and to John Bain. This has been the Albion Raw on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on a podcast. I've been Aidy Packham. Thanks for listening. We'll see you again next week. Bye.
It's true. They got a message from the action man. I'm happy. Hope you're happy too. I've loved all of needed love. Saw the details fall away. The shrieking of nothing is killing. Just pictures of Jeff girls and synthesis. And I ain't got no money. Ashes to ash and fuck to fuck it. We know Major Tom's a junkie, strung out in heaven's high, hitting an all-time low. Time and again I tell myself I'll stay clean. Ashes, fun to fuck.